Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, TAVI in the USA, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Jeffrey J. Popma, MD, and David H. Adams, MD. Dr. Popma is a director, interventional cardiology, Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, associate professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Popma has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received grants for clinical research from Abbott Laboratories, Boston Scientific, Cordis Corporation, and Medtronic. Dr. Popma does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Popma does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Adams is a Marie Jose and Henry R. Kravis Professor and Chairman, Department of Cardiothoracic Surgery, Mount Sinai Medical Center, New York, New York. Dr. Adams has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He received royalties from Edwards Life Sciences and Medtronic. He served as a co-primary investigator for Medtronic. Dr. Adams does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Adams does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this activity is to educate clinicians on the potential role of transcatheter aortic valve implantation in managing patients with severe AS. This activity is supported by Medtronic. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, I'm Jeffrey Popma, Director of Interventional Cardiology at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston and Associate Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Our program today will focus on transcatheter aortic valve implantation in the United States. While one transcatheter aortic valve was recently approved by the Food and Drug Administration, please note that this program will also discuss investigational devices not yet approved by the FDA for use in the United States. I have the real pleasure of being joined today by Dr. David Adams, Marie Jose, and Henry R. Kravis, Professor and Chairman at the Department of Cardiovascular Surgery at the Mount Sinai Medical Center in New York. David, welcome.
Thanks, Jeff.
Let's kick off with a quick overview of some of the findings from the groundbreaking PARTNER trial, and then we'll advance on to other U.S. trials that we've been both involved with here in the United States. Now, across the entire spectrum of aortic valve disease, I think one of the things we've really come to understand is the gradation of risk. And for a variety of different reasons, the highest risks or patients who were deemed to be extreme risk or inoperable were really selected for our initial studies. One of the things that we're learning is this understanding of cohort C, patients who aren't certainly going to benefit from the replacement of aortic valve, either surgically or using transcatheter routes. What's your view as a surgeon, David, about how we've identified risk? Have we done enough? Too high? Too low? Where do you think we stand?
Jeff, I think we've done a really good job. I think that this idea that we had early on to get surgeons involved and create a risk document considering factors outside that were the outside of the STS risk model was really a good one. For example, if you spend your life in a wheelchair, that obviously has a prognostic implication that's not captured in the STS, and there's a whole host of things like that. But I think we've done a really good job, and I think we've had very aggressive, if you will, screening calls led by our good friend Dr. Michael Reardon. And I think we've been really careful trying to ask the question both, are you going to live a year, trying to identify futile patients. I like that phrase, futile, or futility. And are you a candidate for surgery? Would you consider operating? And I think we've done a really good job, and I think we've done have some objective data behind it, because we've been very careful to document, for example, porcelain or aorta and things like that. So I think we've done a good job.
So I guess the concept is that to assess risk, it's a multidisciplinary team that assesses risk. It's cardiologists who know the patients, it's cardiac surgeons who understand risk, and then what we do is we identify those patients who have high risk. Well, certainly in the U.S., we've had to sit in the randomized trial format, and I think by review, both the Partner B, which was patients who were deemed to be inoperative for conventional surgical therapy, and then randomized to medical therapy or to TAVI, and then those patients who were deemed to be high risk, greater than 15% risk, randomized to either TAVI or to surgical therapy, and we have those results, and I think they're very provocative. From a surgical perspective, are these game changers?
Well, I think they are. I think that to start with, the extreme risk, we like to call it extreme risk, partners call it inoperable. I think extreme risk, we made the point you can operate on anyone. I think extreme risk is I hope the phrase that's going to catch on for subgroup. There's no question that's been a game changer. I think we still have to work on the identifying patients where we're not going to help them just because we can put a device in. But there is clearly a subgroup that Partners has admirably demonstrated in a fantastic trial by investigators are going to benefit from the device implantation. And I think, Jeff, the other thing we've learned from this early look at this emerging field is how safe it's been for patients. Yeah. It's just remarkable that this new technology being done in rollout centers has been so safe. And that is the hallmark, I think, of the beginning of letting us expand it to get more information.
Well, certainly one of the key features that we have had as designing the core valve study has been that there was a predicate trial design. So the predicate trial design in the extreme risk patients or inoperable patients was versus medical therapy, randomized, and then at high risk versus surgical therapy, and that was a bit of a challenge, particularly after we had that. One of the things that's been absolutely mandatory in our core valve studies has been the involvement of surgery, you know, both at the PI level yourself as well as all the local sites and all the committees. I think what we learned a year ago was that it's very difficult to randomize those inoperable patients to medical therapy. So we had to deal with that as we were designing the studies. And we also learned that stroke was a more important outcome than we'd previously appreciated. And so we've been very meticulous about characterizing stroke. And I think one of the things we'll talk about in just a second is this whole concept of alternative access. The fact that if we can't go up with a normal transfemoral approach, that we've got some other ways to go. So to briefly review the core valve clinical study, our extreme risk patients, those who we think are futile, we first assess whether they have adequate iliofemoral anatomy. And if they do, then they go into the core valve single arm registry. That's where we're going to evaluate things versus a performance goal. And if they don't have adequate iliofemoral access, then we move them into the non-iliofemoral access group. First we had 100, now we have 200. Could you comment about this as a surgeon, about access sites and what this has meant for treating patients?
Yeah, Jeff, I think you've hit one of the really important points that we've learned over the last year. I think we were all primarily focused on stroke. I think we've spent a lot of time thinking about femoral artery access in particular and the potential for injury. And I think we had to because we recognize our patients are different than the partner's patients. We have a smaller device, so our vascular burden is greater for these patients. So I think we as a screening committee, have had to take a very close look and really be careful because we've had patients with a lot more, that the burden of vascular disease peripherally is greater than what the partner's investigators face. Those patients got transferred into their transapical side on the randomized trial, but in our series, I think we've had to be very careful, and I think our exploration of direct access and subclavian access has actually been not only important, but it's actually been very rewarding because we've been able to offer a lot of patients this therapy that otherwise would not have been candidates.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's been a huge adjunct, and you know, it's up to 20 to 30% of patients that we treat. And then we have our high-risk arm. I want to come back to some of the issues that you raised in just a second. 790 patients randomized to either treatment with surgical aortic valve replacement or to conventional therapy.
But Jeff, you know, I think that one of the concerns people had originally was, well, since we don't have a transapical arm, how is surgery really going to be involved? And I think as it's turned out, they've been extremely involved because I think this direct access is going to be a fair, I predict it will overtake transapical, and it's going to always mean that the heart team is making decisions because I think that we can already see this in Europe. A third of patients will be alternate access. So that's going to require really patient-to-patient decision-making.
So let's go into a couple of other issues that I think that have been unique with the study so far, and one of them is the imaging, and I think that one of the key features for the current TAVI studies that we're doing right now is that we really have 100% independent review of all the angiograms, of the echoes, and of the CT angiograms, both the chest and then the abdomen pelvis. What do you think about using these imaging modalities for a clinical study?
Well, I think it's been really important for safety for patients, particularly as we built up our experience, Jeff. I think what's going to be interesting, and what I've always emphasized, is you cannot underestimate the level of support we've gotten in this clinical trial. I mean, from the proctors, the proctor level, and these national screening calls, where it's not just your on-site sort of evaluating and trying to decide between sizes and are you a candidate or not, or do you have a contraindication based on anatomy, but it's this external review of this data that I think is making this trial so much safer for patients. And I'm sure the same factors were responsible for some of the excellent outcomes we saw in the PARTNERS trial.
Yeah, no, I think that screening.
So we're going to have to come up with a way that we mimic that in the real world down the road. We're really going to have to pay a lot of attention to that. And of course, the good news is there's a lot of continued advancement in imaging modality. Our understanding and getting our comfort level with things like circumference as opposed to diameter, recognizing diameter changes across the valve. I think there are a lot of things we're still learning, but I think we're getting a lot better at doing this. And of course, from our perspective, we're also learning the nuances of things like implantation depth versus calcification on the leaflet. So there's a lot of subtleties, like in any surgical intervention, that you learn with experience. And I think our investigators have done an excellent job of communicating that, as our proctors.
So you mentioned something about the CT measurements and moving towards perimeter measurements for sizing. You know, the focus for that has really been to reduce paravalvular leak. If anything, we're moving higher. I mean, our CT measurements seem to be higher than what we're getting by echocardiography. And we've had a big focus on reducing paravalvular leak in the midst of the procedure. Part of it's sizing, but part of it's procedural techniques as well. Do you think that's going to be important?
I think it's going to be important, Jeff. I think, again, the good news for this field, whether it's in the Sapien or Medtronic core valve, is there'll be more devices. This 31-millimeter device is going to provide access for us for a lot more patients, and also mean we're not reaching quite so much with our large device. So I think that it's critically important, that, and especially we've seen it in our own experiences, we start to recognize some of the greater subtleties of leaflet calcification, the depth that you're trying to implant these things, and the size. I think all this cumulative is coming together, and I've been impressed that that's actually not been something we've been particularly concerned about. It does not appear to me, certainly in our own experience, that it's been a significant issue. I think we're doing a good job of handling paravalvular issues.
Yeah, and I think that's a combined piece of both using the hemodynamics of the angiography that we have, aortography that we have, and then using intracardiac echo, so whether it be TTE, TE, or ICE, to sort out exactly the degree of paravalvular leak.
Jeff, let me ask you a different question about that. I'll ask you about your own experience with the pacemaker issue, which has always been, at least it's been identified, and we know just based on the design of self-expanding technology, we assume we'll have a higher pacemaker rate. Of course, I've been impressed with the number of patients that come to us in this high-risk cohort or extreme-risk cohort already with pacemaker, which has been 20-25%, but how do you think that's going to play out? Our own sort of feeling is that we're not seeing as many as we were prepared for, certainly in our own center. That's just a small experience, but I mean, how do you see that sort of moving, and in your own clinical experience, what would you call your current sort of incidence, and what are you telling patients?
Well, I think that we still are we're obligated to talk about 20-30% pacemaker rates to our patients for consenting, but we're trying to focus on a number of things to prevent that. Sizing's key, right? So we've really done a very, very good job, I think, with aneurysm sizing. We're under-dilating. We're using the CT angio to say that we're using a little bit smaller size balloons. I think that's important. In fact, some investigators are not using balloon dilatation at all. We still are.
We are, too.
We have focused on the depth of implantation with very, very trying to be less than 6 millimeters or so below the non-coronary annulus, and so that's an important piece to do. Post-dilatation, we've been very careful not to over-post-dilate, but make sure we have enough if we need to for perivalvular leak. And then finally, been watching patients and make sure that they have real clinical indication. A new left bundle branch isn't an indication for pacemaker, but if they do have heart block, I think that we put the pacemakers in and we don't think much about it. But we want to make sure that we plan enough ahead of time to try to minimize that.
Jeff, I think you're right. When we tell patients the same thing, we tell them historically what the data is, because that's the way you get you should do an informed consent. But it's my feeling is that we're getting better, yeah. And Nicola and other investigators, yeah, are showing us the way.
Yeah.
But I think it'll be very interesting, yeah, to see this data point. But I feel confident we are going to have we are going to be talking to patients differently about pacemaker with a Medtronic core valve device than we were 2 years ago.
Yeah, I agree with you. Now listen, we have to kind of switch gears here a little bit. We've talked about the non-operable patients, we've talked about the high-risk patients. Let's move for a second for this intermediate-risk patients. And you and I, of course, were involved with the SATAVI trial. The,
sure,
PARTNER 2A was approved on November the 4th. So could you speak for just a second about this intermediate-risk trial and what that's going to mean for patients?
Well, I think it's going to put a much larger percentage of patients as a candidate for the device. People may not be aware that there are, they may be aware, but I'll reinforce it that, you know, less than 10% of patients are actually qualify for these,
yeah,
trials now, because it's not that, it's much more common to have aortic sclerosis,
right,
or symptomatic aortic stenosis and not have an STA score,
right,
of 8 or greater.
Right.
So this is now going to focus on patients in Europe between STS of 3 and 8 for SIRTAVI and 4 and 8 in the United States. Notice in Europe, we really moved it down a point because the investigators just really,
right,
felt like,
right,
they,
right,
needed to get to that point to really have a trial that to sort of met where they were clinically right now. So I think it's going to broadly expand the pool. I think with that comes responsibility. I think we're ready to assume that, because I think based on both the partners' data as well as our own experience, we can expand this safely in the short term, which is why,
yeah,
I brought up why it's so important that your peri-procedural risk are low. And I think that with that data behind us, I think we're ready to do this,
yep,
and I know investigators around the world are excited,
yeah,
about it.
We are. I mean, it's randomized data. It's not what we've gotten about a good registry series. It tells us the answer. It gives us comparable information. I think as painful as randomization is, I think that in these subgroups of patients, it's critically important.
It's going to be interesting, Jeff, too, is for instance, in SIRTAVI, we're going to allow PCI as well. You know, you're,
yep,
going to be able to treat both diseases at once. So there's a lot of new information that's going to come out of these trials.
Do you think some of these off-label uses for some patients? I mean, we have case studies of patients with low ejection fractions and bicuspid disease and valve-in-valve. Should they be studied in some sense?
Well, I know you and I have the same feeling. I feel like everything in this, every as much as we can learn prospectively and controlled trials is the best way to expand,
yep,
this field. There are certain, I'm sure that we can all come up with a certain, you know, an individual patient that has so many circumstances that wouldn't make them a candidate for anything we'd all like to treat. But I think at this point, at this state of the field, we still need to have as much prospective data as we,
yep,
can accumulate. What do you think?
Well, I think we do. I mean, I think that when we move into the, these other groups, I mean, certainly these patients are desperate. We know in the extreme risk groups they don't have options, and we know that their mortality rate's 50%. And so I think we have to be able to offer them something. And I think that data is better than no data. And to study them, I think, would be very, very important. Certainly that's going to be the perspective for the future. Well, listen, our time's up, unfortunately, and I think it's been a very, very important TCT so far. It has been an action-packed sessions of expanded data, both enforcing what we know about those non-operative patients, moving into better understanding of the outcomes of the higher risk patients, talking about these different subsets of patients, and also making sure that we have the appropriate tools to identify those patients who aren't good for this therapy. What do you envision, David, the next year is going to look like?
Well, Jeff, you know, I think the spirit of TCT this year is just showing where we're continuing to move. It's incredible. I think we've rediscovered partnership between cardiology and our interventional cardiologists and cardiac,
yep,
surgery,
yep,
right now. And that's been so evident at this meeting. And I think what we're going to see next year is a lot of exciting things. We'll finish enrolling our extreme risk arm very soon. We'll finish enrolling our high risk arm by next summer, and we'll see what happens with the partners' A data. So there's a lot of new information that's going to come out. There are other devices that are going to come and be in trial, and I think these trials to expand into lower risk patients are going to be incredibly anticipated, not just by physicians, but also by patients. So it's a very exciting time.
And I think it's key that we have to be responsible. I think we have to be responsible, make sure we do the right patients with the right device and right treatment.
I've been really impressed, though. I think all of the companies that are involved, as well as the investigators, and frankly, most of the community listening to this data, have all bought into that and really stressed that at every level.
Okay. Well, listen, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Jeff.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, TAVI in the USA. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.